control. "No, I mean it," I say. I say I could just kill the guy who invented the dildo. I really could. The music changes to an air raid siren. Then a new dancer struts out, glowing pink inside some sheer baby doll lingerie, her bush and breasts so almost there. She drops one strap off her shoulder. She sucks on her index finger. Her other shoulder strap drops, and it's only her breasts that keep her lingerie from falling to the floor. Denny and me both watching her. The lingerie drops. Chapter 32. When a tow truck from the auto club gets here, the front desk girl needs to go out to meet it, so I tell her, sure, I'll watch her desk. For serious, but when the bus dropped me off at St. Anthony's today, I noticed two of her tires were flat. Both rear wheels were resting right on the rims. I told her and forced myself to make eye contact the whole time. The security monitor shows the dining room, where old women are eating different shades of gray mashed food for lunch. The intercom dial is set on number one, and you can hear elevator music and water running somewhere. The monitor cycles through the craft room, empty. 10 seconds pass. Then the day room, where the television is dark. Then 10 seconds later, the library, where Paige is pushing my mom in her wheelchair past the shelves of battered old books. With the intercom control, I dial switch around until I hear them on number 6. I wish I had the courage not to fight and doubt everything my mom says. She reaches out and touches the spine of a book, saying, "I wish just once I could say this. This is good enough, just because I choose it." She takes the book out, sees the cover, and shoves the book back on the shelf, shaking her head. And from the speaker, scratchy and muffled, my mom's voice says, "How did you decide to become a doctor?" Paige shrugs. "You have to trade your youth for something," she says. The monitor cycles to a view of the empty loading dock behind St. Anthony's. Now in voiceover, my mom's voice says, "But how did you make the commitment?" And Paige's voiceover says, "I don't know. One day I just wanted to be a doctor," and fades into some other room. The monitor cycles to a view of the front parking lot, where a tow truck is parked, and the driver is kneeling next to a blue car. The front desk girl stands off to one side with her arms folded. I dial switch from number to number, listening. The monitor cycles to show me sitting with my ear to the intercom speaker. There's the clatter of somebody typing on number 5. On 8, there's the whir of a blow dryer. On 2, I hear my mom's voice saying, "You know the old phrase, those who don't remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Well, I think those who remember their past are even worse off." In voiceover, Paige says, "Those who remember the past tend to get the story really screwed up." The monitor cycles to show them going down a corridor. A book open in my mom's lap. Even in black and white, you can tell it's her diary, and she's reading it, smiling. She looks up, twisting to see Paige behind the wheelchair, and says, "In my opinion, those who remember the past are paralyzed by it." And Paige pushes her along, saying, "How about those who can forget the past are way ahead of the rest of us?" And their voices fade out again. There's somebody snoring on number 3. On number 10, there's the creak of a rocking chair. The monitor cycles to show the front parking lot, where the girl is signing something on a clipboard. Before I can find Paige again, the front desk girl will be back, saying her tires are fine. She'll be looking at me sideways again. What would Jesus not do? As it turns out, some asshole just let the air out of them. Chapter 33. Wednesdays mean Nico, Fridays mean Tanya, Sundays mean Lisa, and I catch her in the parking lot at the community center. 2 doors down from the sexaholics meeting, we waste some sperm in a janitor's closet with a mop next to us left standing in a bucket of gray water. There's cases of toilet tissue for Lisa to lean over, and I'm splitting her ass so hard that with every drive she headbutts a shelf of folded rags. I'm licking the sweat off her back for a nicotine buzz. This is life on Earth as I knew it. The kind of rough, messy sex where you first want to spread some newspapers, This is me trying to put things back the way they were before Page Marshall, period revival. Me trying to reconstruct how my life worked until just a few weeks ago, how my dysfunction used to function so beautifully. Asking the back of Lisa's scrubby hair, I say, "You'd tell me if I was getting too sweet, wouldn't you?" Pulling her hips back against me, I say, "Tell me the truth." I'm ramming at a regular steady pace, asking, "You don't think I'm getting soft, do you?" To keep from triggering, I picture airplane crash sites and stepping in crap. My dog burning hard, I imagine police photos of car wrecks and point-blank shotgun damage. To keep from feeling anything, I just keep stuffing it. Stuffing dick, stuffing feelings. When you're a sexaholic, it's for sure the same thing. Plugged in deep, I reach around her. Forced in tight, I reach under her to twist a hard-pointed nipple in each hand. And sweating her dark brown shadow into the light brown case of toilet paper, Lisa says, "Ease up." She says, "Just what are you trying to prove?" "That I'm an unfeeling jerk. That I really don't care. What would Jesus not do?" Lisa, with her three-hour release form, she grips the case of toilet paper and hacks and coughs, and with my hands I feel her abs spasm rock hard and rippling between my fingers. The muscles of her pelvic floor, the pubococcygeus muscles, called the PC muscles for short, they spasm, and the clenched drag on my dog is incredible. See also the Grafenberg spot. See also the goddess spot. See also tantric sacred spot. See also Taoist black pearl. Lisa spreads her hands open against the wall and shoves herself back at me. All these names for the same place, all these symbols for the real thing. The Federation of Feminist Health Care Centers calls it their urethral sponge. The 17th century Dutch anatomist Rainer de Graaf called this same mass of erectile tissue, nerves, and glands the female prostate. All these names for the 2 inches of urethra you can feel through the front wall of the vagina, the anterior wall of the vagina, what some people call the bladder neck. All of this just the same bean-shaped territory everyone wants to name, to stake with their own flag, their symbol. To keep from triggering, I picture first-year anatomy and dissecting out the 2 legs of the clitoris, the crura, each about as long as your index finger. Picture dissecting out the corpus cavernosa, the 2 cylinders of erectile tissue in the penis. We cut out the ovaries, we remove the testes, we learn to cut out all the nerves and lay them off to one side. The cadaver stinking with formalin, formaldehyde, that new car smell. With this cadaver stuff in mind, you can ride for hours without getting anywhere. You can kill a lifetime without feeling anything but skin. That's the magic of these sexaholic chicks. When you're an addict, you can go without feeling anything except drunk or stoned or hungry. Still, when you compare this to other feelings, to sadness, anger, fear, worry, despair, and depression, well, an addiction no longer looks so bad. It looks like a very viable option. Monday, I stay home after work and sort through my mom's old tapes from therapy sessions. Here are 2,000 years of women on one shelf. Here's my mother's voice, deep and steady, the way it was when I was a little shit. The bordello of the subconscious. Bedtime stories. Imagine a heavy weight pressing your body, settling your head and arms deeper and deeper into the cushions of the couch. The tape playing in headphones. Remember to fall asleep on a towel. Here's the name Mary Todd Lincoln on one taped session. No way. Too ugly. See also the Wallace Simpson session. See also the Martha Ray session. Here's the 3 Bronte sisters. Not real women, but symbols. Just their names as empty shells you can project into. You can fill with antique stereotypes and cliches. Milk white skin and bustles. Button shoes and hoop skirts. Naked, except for whalebone corsets and crochet snoods. Here are Emily and Charlotte and Anne Bronte, lying around naked and bored on horsehair settees one hot, fetid afternoon in the parlor. Sex symbols. You fill in the rest. The props and positions, the roll-top desk, the pump organ. Insert yourself as Heathcliff or Mr. Rochester. Just put in the tape and relax. As if we can ever imagine the past, the future, life on other planets. Everything is such an extension, such a projection of life as we know it. Me locked in my room, Denny comes and goes, as if it's just some innocent accident. I catch myself thumbing through the marshals in the phone book. She's not listed. After work some nights, I take the bus that goes past St. Anthony's. She's never in any of the windows. Riding past, you can't guess which is her car in the parking lot. I don't get off. Whether I'd slash her tires or leave a love note, I don't know. Denny comes and goes, and every day there's fewer rocks in the house. And if you don't see somebody every day, you see them change. Me watching from an upstairs window, Denny comes and goes pushing bigger and bigger rocks in a shopping cart, and every day Denny looks a little bigger inside his old plaid shirt. His face gets tan, his chest and shoulders get big enough to spread the plaid out so it doesn't hang in folds. He's not huge, but he's getting bigger, big for Denny. Watching Denny from the window, I am a rock, I am an island. I call down, does he want any help? On the sidewalk, Denny looks around, his arms hugging a rock to his chest. Up here, I say, do you need me to help you? Denny heaves the rock into his shopping cart and shrugs. He shakes his head and looks up at me, one hand shading his eyes. I don't need help, he says, but you can help if you want. Never mind. What I want is to be needed. What I need is to be indispensable to somebody. Who I need is somebody who will eat up all my free time, my ego, my attention, somebody addicted to me, a mutual addiction. See also Paige Marshall. It's the same way a drug can be something good and something bad. You don't eat, you don't sleep. Eating Lisa isn't really eating. Sleeping with Sarah Bernhardt, you're not really asleep. The magic of sexual addiction is you don't ever feel hungry or tired or bored or lonely. On the dining room table, all the new cards pile up, all the checks and best wishes from a lot of strangers who want to believe they're somebody's hero, who think they're needed. Some woman writes about how she started a prayer chain for me, a spiritual pyramid scheme, as if you can gang up on God, bully him around. The fine line between praying and nagging. Tuesday evening, a voice on the answering machine is asking for my permission to move my mom up to the third floor at St. Anthony's, the floor where you go to die. What I hear first is this isn't Dr. Marshall's voice. Yelling back at the answering machine, I say, sure, move the crazy bitch upstairs. Make her comfortable, but I'm not paying for any heroic measures, feeding tubes, respirators. The way I act could be nicer. But the soft way the administrator talks to me, the hush in her voice, the way she assumes that I'm a nice person. I tell her soft little recorded voice not to call me again until Mrs. Mancini is good and dead. Unless I'm scamming for money, I'd rather people hate me than feel sorry for me. Hearing this, I'm not angry, I'm not sad, all I feel anymore is horny. And Wednesdays mean Nico. In the women's room, the padded fist of her pubic bone punching me in the nose, Nico wipes and smears herself up and down my face. For 2 hours, Nico laces her fingers together across the back of my head and pulls my face into her until I'm choking down pubic hair. Tonguing inside her labia minora, I'm tonguing the folds of Dr. Marshall's ear, breathing through my nose, I'm stretching my tongue toward salvation. Thursday is Virginia Woolf first, then Anais Nin. Then there's just enough time for a session with Sacagawea before it's morning and I have to go to work in 1734. In between, I write down my past in my notebook. This is doing my fourth step, my fearless and complete moral inventory. Fridays mean Tanya. By Friday, there are no more rocks in my mom's house. Tanya comes by the house. And Tanya means anal. The magic of getting butt is she's as tight as a virgin every time. And Tanya brings toys, beads and rods and probes. These all smell like bleach, and she smuggles them around in a black leather bag she keeps in the trunk of her car. Tanya works my dog with one hand and her mouth while she presses the first ball on a long string full of greasy red rubber balls against my trap door. My eyes closed, I'm trying to relax enough. Breathe in, then out. Think of the monkey and the chestnuts. Slow and even, in and then out. Tanya twisting the first ball against me, I say, "You'd tell me if I sounded too needy, wouldn't you?" And the first ball pops inside. "Why don't people believe me," I say, "when I tell them I just don't care?" And the second ball pops inside. "I really can't give a shit about anything," I say. Another ball pops inside. "I'm not going to get hurt again," I say. Something else pops inside of me. Tanya, still throating my dog, she makes a fist around the dangling string and yanks. Imagine a woman yanking your guts out. See also my dying mother. See also Dr. Paige Marshall. Tanya yanks again, and my dog triggers, the white soldiers gobbing against the bedroom wallpaper beside her face. She yanks again, and my dog's coughing dry and still coughing. And still triggering dry, I say, "Damn, for serious, I felt that." What would Jesus not do? Leaning forward, with both my hands spread against the wall, my knees folding a little, I say, "Easy does it," I tell Tanya. "You're not starting a lawnmower." And Tanya, kneeling under me, still looking at the greasy, stinking balls on the floor, she says, "Oh boy." She lifts the string of red rubber balls for me to see, and she says, "There are supposed to be 10. There's only 8, and what looks like a lot of empty string." My ass hurts so much. I finger around back there, and then check my fingers for blood. As much as I hurt right now, you'd be amazed there's not blood everywhere. And gritting my teeth, I say, "That was fun, don't you think?" And Tanya says, "I need you to sign my release form so I can go back to jail." She's dangling the string of balls into her black bag and says, "You're going to want to stop by an emergency room. See also impacted colon. See also bowel blockage. See also cramping, fever, septic shock, heart failure." It's been 5 days since I remember feeling hungry enough to eat. I haven't been tired, or worried, or angry, or afraid, or thirsty. If the air in here smells bad, I can't tell. I only know this is Friday because Tanya is here. Paige in her dental floss, Tanya in her toys, Gwen with her safe word. All these women are yanking me around on a string. "No, really," I tell Tanya. I sign the form under sponsor and say, "Really, nothing's wrong. I don't feel anything left inside." And Tanya takes the form and says, "I can't believe that." What's funny is, I'm still not sure I believe it either. Chapter 34. Without insurance or even a driver's license, I call a cab to come jumpstart my mom's old car. On the radio, they talk about where to find traffic. A two-car accident on the bypass. A stalled tractor-trailer on the airport freeway. After I fill the gas tank, I just find an accident and get in line, just to feel like I'm part of something. Sitting in traffic, my heart would beat at regular speed. I'm not alone. Trapped there, I could just be a normal person headed home to a wife, kids, a house. I could pretend that my life was more than just waiting for the next disaster, that I knew how to function. The way other kids play house, I could play commuter. After work, I go visit Denny on the empty block where he's laid out his rocks, the old Menningtown country townhouses block, where he's pasting row on top of row with mortar until he's already got a wall, and I say, "Hey," and Denny says, "Dude." Denny says, "How's your mom?" And I say, "I don't care." Denny trowels a layer of gritty gray mud on top of the last row of stones. With a pointed steel end of the trowel, he fusses with the mortar until it's even. With a stick, he smooths the joints between rocks he's already laid. A girl sitting under an apple tree close enough, you can see she's Cherry Daiquiri from the strip club. A blanket is spread out under her, and she's lifting white cartons of takeout food from a brown grocery bag and opening each carton. Then he starts bedding stones into the new mortar. I say, "What are you building?" Denny shrugs. He twists a brown rock deeper into the mortar. With a trowel, he chinks mortar between two stones, assembling his whole generation of babies into something huge. Doesn't he need to build it on paper first, I say? Don't you need a plan? There's permits and inspections you have to get. You have to pay fees. There's building codes you have to know. And then he says, how come? He rolls around rocks with his foot, then finds the best one and fits it in place. You don't need a permit to paint a picture, he says. You don't need to file a plan to write a book. There are books that do more damage than he ever could. You don't need your poem inspected. There's such a thing as freedom of expression. Denny says, you don't need a permit to have a baby. So why do you need to buy permission to build a house? And I say, but what if you build a dangerous, ugly house? And Denny says, well, what if you raise a dangerous, assholey kid? And I hold my fist up between us and say, you better not mean me, dude. Denny looks over at Cherry Daiquiri, sitting in the grass, and says, her name's Beth. Don't think for a minute that the city is going to buy your First Amendment logic, I say. And I say, she's not really as attractive as you think. With the bottom of his shirt, Denny wipes the sweat off his face. You can see his abs are rippled armor, and he says, you need to go see her. I can see her from here. Your mom, I mean, Denny says. She doesn't know me anymore. She won't miss me. Not for her, Denny says. You need to go complete this for you. Denny, his arms flicker with shadows where his muscles flex. Denny, now his arms stretch the sleeves of his sour t-shirt. His skinny arms look big around. His pinched shoulders spread wide. With every row, he's having to lift the stones a little higher. With every row, he's having to be a little stronger. Denny says, you want to stay for Chinese food? He says, you look a little wasted. I ask, is he living with this Beth girl now? I ask if he's got her pregnant or anything. And Denny, lugging a big gray rock with both hands at his waist, he shrugs. A month ago, this was a rock the two of us could hardly lift together. If he needs it, I tell him, I got my mom's old car running. Go see how your mom is, Denny says, then come and help. Everybody at Colonial Dunsborough says to say hello, I tell him. And Denny says, don't lie to me, dude. I'm not the one who needs cheering up. Chapter 35. Fast forwarding through the messages on my mom's answering machine, there's the same soft voice, hushed and understanding, saying, condition is deteriorating, saying, critical, saying, mother, saying, intervene. I just keep hitting the fast forward button. Still on the shelf for tonight, there's Colleen Moore, whoever she was. There's Constance Lloyd, whoever that is. There's Judy Garland, there's Eva Braun. What's left is definitely the second string. The voice on the message machine stops and starts. Been calling some of the fertility clinics listed in your mother's diary, it says. It's Paige Marshall. I rewind. Hello, this is Dr. Marshall, she says. I need to talk to Victor Mancini. Please tell Mr. Mancini that I've been calling some of the fertility clinics listed in his mother's diary, and they all seem to be legitimate. Even the doctors are real, she says. The oddest part is that they get very upset when I ask them about Ida Mancini. She says, this is looking like something more than just Mrs. Mancini's fantasy. A voice in the background says, Paige? A man's voice. Listen, she says, my husband's here. So would Victor Mancini please visit me at St. Anthony's Care Center as soon as possible? The man's voice says, Paige, what are you up to? Why are you whispering? And the line goes dead. Chapter 36. So Saturday means visiting my mom. In the lobby of St. Anthony's, talking to the front desk girl, I tell her I'm Victor Mancini, and I'm here to see my mom, Ida Mancini. I say, unless she's dead. The front desk girl gives me that look, the one where you tuck your chin down and look at the person you feel so, so sorry for. You tilt your face down so your eyes have to look up at the person, that look of submission. Lift your eyebrows into your hairline as you look up. It's that look of infinite pity. squash your mouth down into a frowny face, and you'll know the exact way the front desk girl is looking at me. And she says, "Of course your mother is still with us." And I say, "Don't take this the wrong way, but I kind of wish she wasn't." Her face forgets for a second how sorry she is, and her lips pull back to show her teeth. The way to make most women break eye contact is to run your tongue around your lips, the ones who don't look away, for serious bingo. "Just go back," she tells me. "Mrs. Mancini is still on the first floor." "It's Miss Mancini," I tell her. "My mom's not married, unless you count me in some creepy Oedipal way. I ask if Paige Marshall is here." "Of course she is," the front desk girl says, now with her face turned a little away from me, looking at me out the corner of her eye, the look of distrust. Beyond the security doors, all the crazy old Irmas and Laverne's, the Violets and Olives, start their slow migration of walkers and wheelchairs coming my way. All the chronic undressers, all the dumped grannies and squirrels with their pockets full of chewed food, the ones who forget how to swallow, their lungs full of food and drink. All of them, smiling at me, beaming. They're all wearing those plastic bracelets that keep the doors locked, but they still look better than I feel. In the day room, the smell of roses and lemons and pine, the loud little world begging for attention from inside the television, the shattered jigsaw puzzles. Nobody's moved my mom up to the third floor yet, the death floor, and in her room, Paige Marshall sitting in a tweed recliner, reading her clipboard with her glasses on, and when she sees me, she says, "Look at you." She says, "Your mom isn't the only one who could use a stomach tube." I say I got her message. "My mom is. She's just in bed. She's just asleep is all, her stomach just a bloated little mound under the covers. Her bones are the only thing left in her arms and hands. Her head sunk in her pillow. She squeezes her eyes shut. The corners of her jaw swell as her teeth clench for a moment, and she brings her whole face together to swallow. Her eyes fall open, and she stretches her green-gray fingers at me, in a creepy underwater way, a slow-motion swimming stroke, trembling the way light does at the bottom of a swimming pool when you're little and staying overnight in some motel just off the highway. The plastic bracelet hangs from her wrist, and she says, "Fred." She swallows again, her whole face bunching with the effort, and says, "Fred Hastings." Her eyes roll to one side, and she smiles at Paige. "Tammy," she says. "Fred and Tammy Hastings." Her old defense attorney and his wife. All my notes for being Fred Hastings are at home. If I drive a Ford or a Dodge, I can't remember. How many kids I'm supposed to have? What color did we finally paint the dining room? I can't remember a single detail about how I'm supposed to live my life. Paige still sitting in the recliner. I step close to her and put a hand on her lab coat shoulder and say, "How are you feeling, Mrs. Mancini?" Her terrible green-gray hand comes up level and rocks from side to side, the universal sign language for so-so. With her eyes closed, she smiles and says, "I was hoping you'd be Victor." Paige shrugs my hand off her shoulder, and I say, "I thought you liked me better." I say, "Nobody likes Victor very much." My mother stretches her fingers toward Paige and says, "Do you love him?" Paige looks at me. "Fred here," my mom says, "do you love him?" Paige starts clicking and unclicking her ballpoint pen fast. Not looking at me, looking at her clipboard in her lap, she says, "I do." And my mom smiles, and stretching her fingers toward me, she says, "And do you love her?" Maybe the way a porcupine thinks about its stinking stick, if you'd call that love. Maybe the way a dolphin loves the smooth sides of its pool. And I say, "I guess." My mom tucks her chin into her neck sideways, eyeballing me, and says, "Fred?" And I say, "Okay, yes," I say, "I love her." My mom brings her terrible green-gray finger back to rest on her mounded belly, and she says, "You two are so lucky." She closes her eyes and says, "Victor isn't very good at loving people." She says, "What I'm most afraid of is, after I'm gone, there will be no one left in the entire world who will love Victor. These frigging old people, these human ruins. Love is bullshit. Emotion is bullshit. I am a rock, a jerk, I'm an uncaring asshole and proud of it. What would Jesus not do? If it comes down to a choice between being unloved and being vulnerable and sensitive and emotional, then you can just keep your love. If what I just said about loving Paige was a lie or a vow, I don't know, but it was a trick. This is just heaps of more chick bullshit. There is no human soul, and I am absolutely, for sure, seriously, not going to fucking cry. My mom, her eyes stay closed, and her chest inflates and deflates in long, deep cycles. Breathe in, breathe out. Imagine a heavy weight pressing your body, settling your head and arms deeper and deeper, and she's asleep. Paige stands up from the recliner and nods her head toward the door, and I follow her out into the hallway. She looks around and says, "You want to go to the chapel?" I'm not really in the mood. "To talk," she says. I say, okay. Walking with her, I say, "Thanks for back there. For lying, I mean." And Paige says, "Who says I was lying? Does that mean she loves me? That's impossible." "Okay," she says, "maybe I fibbed a little. I like you, some." Breathe in, breathe out. In the chapel, Paige shuts the door behind us and says, "Feel," and takes my hand to hold it against her flat stomach. "I checked my temperature," she says. "It's not my time anymore." With the load already building up behind whatever in my guts, I tell her, "Yeah?" I say, "Well, I may have beat you to it, Tanya and her rubber butt toys." Paige turns and walks away from me, slow and still turned away. She says, "I don't know how to talk to you about this." The sun through the stained glass window, a whole wall in 100 shades of gold, the blonde wood cross, symbols, the altar and the communion rail, it's all here. Paige goes to sit on one of the benches, a pew, and she sighs. Her one hand grips the top of her clipboard, and her other lifts some clipped papers to show something red underneath. My mom's diary. She hands the diary to me and says, "You can check the facts yourself. In fact, I recommend you do so, if only for your own peace of mind." I take the book, and it's still gibberish inside. Okay, Italian gibberish. And Paige says, "The only good thing is, there's no absolute assurance that the genetic material they used was from the actual historic figure. Everything else checks out," she says. "The dates, the clinics, the specialists. Even the church people she talked to have insisted the material stolen, the tissue the clinic cultured, was the only authenticated foreskin." She says this has opened a giant political can of worms in Rome. "The only other good thing," she says, "is I didn't tell anybody who you were." "Jesus Christ," I say. "No, I mean who you are now," she says. And I say, "No, I was just swearing." How this feels is like I just got back to Rome on a bad biopsy. I say, "So what does this mean?" Paige shrugs. "When you think about it, nothing," she says. She nods toward the diary in my hand and says, "Unless you want to ruin your life, I'd recommend you burn that." I ask, "How does this affect us, her and me?" "We shouldn't see each other anymore," she says, "if that's what you mean." I ask, "She doesn't believe this junk, does she?" And Paige says, "I've seen you with the patients here, the way they're all at peace after they talk to you." Sitting there, she leans forward, with her elbows on her knees and her chin in her hands, and she says, "I just can't take the chance that your mother is right. Not everybody I talk to in Italy could be delusional. I mean, what if you're really the beautiful and divine Son of God? The blessed and perfect mortal manifestation of God." A belch rumbles up from my blockage, and the taste in my mouth is acid. Morning sickness isn't the right term, but it's the first term that comes to mind. "So what you're saying," I say, "is you'll only sleep with mortals?" And Paige, leaning forward, she gives me that pity look, the one the front desk girl does so well, with her chin tucked to her chest, her eyebrows lifted into her hairline, and she says, "I'm so sorry I butted in. I promise you, I won't tell a soul." "And what about my mom?" Paige sighs and shrugs. "That's easy. She's delusional. Nobody would believe her. No, I mean, will she die soon? Probably, Paige says, unless there's a miracle. Chapter 37. Ursula stops to catch her breath and looks up at me. She shakes the fingers of her one hand and squeezes the wrist with her other hand and says, "If you were at Churn, we'd have butter a half hour ago." I go, "Sorry." She spits in her hand and makes a fist around my dog and says, "This sure isn't like you. Anymore, I won't even pretend to know what I'm like. For sure, this is just another slow day in 1734, so we're flopped in a pile of hay in the stable. Me with my arms crossed behind my head, Ursula is curled up against me. We don't move very much, or the dry hay pokes us through our clothes. We both look up into the rafters, the wood beams, and woven underside of the thatched roof. Spiders dangle down on their strands of web. Ursula starts yanking and says, "You see Denny on television?" "When?" "Last night." "What for?" Ursula shakes her head. "Building something," she says. "People are complaining. People think it's some kind of church, and he won't say what kind. It's pathetic how we can't live with the things we can't understand. How we need everything labeled and explained and deconstructed. Even if it's for sure unexplainable. Even God." Diffused isn't the right word, but it's the first word that comes to mind. "It's not a church," I say. I throw my cravat back over one shoulder and pull the front of my shirt out of my pants. And Ursula says, "They think it's a church on TV." With the fingertips of one hand, I press around my navel, the umbilicus. But digital palpitation is inconclusive. I tap and listen for changes in sound that might indicate a solid mass, but precussing is inconclusive. The big trapdoor muscle that keeps the shit inside you, doctors call that the rectal shelf, and after you shove something above that shelf, no way is it coming out without a lot of help. In hospital emergency rooms, they call this kind of help colorectal foreign bodies management. To Ursula, I say, "Could she put her ear against my bare stomach and tell me if she hears anything?" "Denny was never very together," she says, and leans in to press her warm ear against my belly button, navel, umbilicus, doctors would call it. A typical patient presenting colorectal foreign bodies is a male in his 40s or 50s. The foreign body is almost always what the doctors would call self-administered. And Ursula says, "What am I listening for?" "Positive bowel sounds." "Gurgles," I say. "Squeaks, rumbles, anything that indicates I'll have a bowel movement someday, and the stool isn't just packing up behind some obstruction." As a clinical entity, the occurrence of colorectal foreign bodies rises dramatically every year. There are reports of foreign bodies that stayed in place for years without perforating the bowel or causing significant health complications. Even if Ursula hears something, it won't be conclusive. Really, this would take an abdominal roentgenogram and proctosigmoidoscopy. Picture yourself on the examining table, with your knees pulled to your chest, in what they call the jackknife position. Your buttocks would be separated and held apart with adhesive tape. Somebody would apply periabdominal pressure, while somebody else would insert two tissue forceps, an attempt to transanally manipulate and extract the foreign body. Of course, this is all done with regional anesthesia. Of course, nobody is giggling and taking pictures, but still. Still, this is me I'm talking about. Picture the sigmoidoscope view on the television screen, a bright light pushing along a clenched tunnel of mucosal tissue, wet and pink, pushing into the puckered darkness until it's there on TV for everybody to see. The dead hamster. See also the Barbie doll head. See also the red rubber butt ball. Ursula's hand has stopped its up and down jumping, and she says, "I can hear your heartbeat." She says, "You sound pretty scared." "No, no way," I tell her. "I'm having a swell time." "You don't feel like it," she says, her breath hot on my periabdominal region. She says, "I'm getting carpal tunnels." "You mean carpal tunnel syndrome," I say. "And you can't, because it won't be invented until the Industrial Revolution. To keep the foreign body from moving higher into the colon, You can provide traction by using a Foley catheter and inserting a balloon into the colon above the body, then inflate the balloon. More common is a vacuum above the foreign body. This is usually the case with self-administered wine or beer bottles. Her ear is still against my belly. Ursula says, "Do you know whose it is?" And I say, "That's not funny." With bottles self-administered open-end first, you have to insert a Robinson catheter around the bottle and allow air to flow past it and break the vacuum. With bottles self-administered closed-end first, insert a retractor into the open end of the bottle, then fill the bottle with plaster. After the plaster sets around the retractor, pull it to remove the bottle. Using enemas is another method, but less reliable. Here with Ursula, in the stables, you can hear it start to rain outside. The rain pattering on the thatch, the water running in the street. The light in the windows is dimmer, dark gray, and there's the quick repeating splash of somebody running for cover. The deformed black and white chickens squeeze in through a broken board in the walls and fluff their feathers to shake off the water. And I say, "What else does the TV say about Denny?" "Denny and Beth." I say, "Do you think Jesus automatically knew he was Jesus from the start? Or did his mom or somebody tell him and he grew into it?" A soft rumble comes up from my lap, but not from inside me. Ursula breathes out, then snores again. Her hand goes limp around me, limp me. Her hair spills across my legs. Her warm, soft ear is sunk into my stomach. The hay itches up through the back of my shirt. The chickens scratch in the dust and hay. The spiders spin. Chapter 38. How to make an ear candle is you take a piece of regular paper and roll it into a thin tube. There's no real miracle to it. Still, you have to start with the stuff you already know. This is just more flotsam and jetsam left over from medical school, something I teach now to the field trip kids at Colonial Dunsborough. Maybe you have to work your way up to the real bona fide miracles. Denny comes to me after stacking rocks outdoors in the rain all day and says he's got earwax so bad he can't hear. He sits in a chair in my mom's kitchen with Beth there, standing by the back door, leaning back a little with her butt against the edge of the kitchen counter. Denny sits with the chair pulled sideways to the kitchen table and one of his arms resting on the table. And I tell him to hold still. Rolling the paper into a tight tube, I say, "Just supposing," I say, "Jesus had to practice being the Son of God to get any good at it." I tell Beth to turn off the kitchen lights, and I twist one end of the thin paper tube into the tight, dark tunnel of Denny's ear. His hair's grown out some, but we're talking less of a fire hazard than most people. Not too deep, I twist the tube into his ear, only far enough so it stays in place. Then I let go. To concentrate, I try and not think of Paige Marshall's ear. "What if Jesus spent all his growing up getting things wrong," I say, "before he ever got a single miracle right?" Denny sitting in the chair in the dark, the white paper tube juts out of his ear. "How is it we don't read about Christ's failed first attempts," I say, "or how he didn't really crank out the big miracles until he was over 30. Beth pushes out the crotch of her tight jeans at me, and I use her zipper to light a kitchen match and carry the little flame across the room to Denny's head. Using the match, I light the end of the paper tube. From striking the match, the room smells full of sulfur. Smoke unwinds from the burning end of the tube, and Denny says, "You're not going to let it burn me, are you?" The flame creeps in closer to his head. The burned end of the tube curls open and comes apart. Black paper edged with warming orange sparks. These little hot bits of paper drift toward the ceiling. Some bits of black paper curl and fall. That's really what this is called, an ear candle. And I say, "How about if Jesus just got started by doing nice things for people? You know, helping old ladies cross the street, or telling people when they'd left their headlights on." I say, "Well, not exactly that, but you get the idea." Watching the fire curl closer and closer to Denny's ear, I say, "How about if Jesus spent years working up to the big loaves and fishes thing? I mean, that Lazarus thing is probably something he'd have to build up to, right?" And Denny's eyes are twisted over to try and see how close the fire is, and he says, "Beth, is it going to burn me?" And Beth looks at me and says, "Victor?" And I say, "It's okay." Leaning back even harder against the kitchen counter, Beth twists her face not to see and says, "It looks like some kind of weird torture." "Maybe," I say, "maybe even Jesus didn't believe in himself at first." And I lean into Denny's face and with one puff blow out the flame. With one hand cupped under Denny's jaw to keep him still, I slip the last of the paper tube out of his ear. When I show it to him, the paper is gummy and dark with the earwax the fire wicked out. Beth turns on the kitchen light. Denny shows the burned little tube to her, and Beth smells it and says, "Stinky." I say, "Maybe miracles are like a talent, and you have to start with the small stuff." Denny puts a hand over his clean ear, and then uncovers it. He covers and uncovers it again, and says, "Definitely better." "I don't mean like Jesus did card tricks," I say, "but just not hurting people would be a good start." Beth comes around, and she holds her hair back with one hand so she can bend and look into Denny's ear. She squints and gets her head around to see in from different angles. Rolling another sheet of paper into a thin tube, I say, "You were on TV the other day, I hear." I say, "I'm sorry." Just twisting the paper tube tighter and tighter in my hands, I say, "That was my fault." Beth stands straight and looks at me. She shakes her hair back. Denny sticks a finger in his clean ear and digs around. Then he smells his finger. And just holding the paper tube, I say, "From now on, I want to try and be a better person. Choking in restaurants, fooling people, I'm not going to do that kind of shit anymore. Sleeping around, casual sex, that kind of shit." I say, "I called the city and complained about you. I called the TV station and told them a bunch of shit. My stomach hurts, but if it's guilt or impacted stool, I can't tell. Either way, I'm full of shit." For a second, it's easier to look in the dark kitchen window above the sink, the night outside. Reflected in the window, there's me looking as wasted and thin as my mom, the new righteous, maybe divine Saint me. There's Beth looking at me with her arms folded. There's Denny sitting beside the kitchen table, digging in his dirty ear with his fingernail. Then he peers under the nail. "The thing is, I just wanted you to need my help," I say. "I wanted you to have to ask me for it." Beth and Denny look at me for real, and I look at all three of us reflected in the window. "Sure, yeah," Denny says. "I need your help." To Beth, he says, "What's this about us being on TV?" And Beth shrugs and says, "It was Tuesday, I think." She says, "No, wait, what is today?" And I say, "So you need me?" And Denny, still sitting in the chair, he nods at the paper tube I've got ready. He lifts his dirty ear to me and says, "Dude, do it again. It's cool. Clean out my other ear." Chapter 39. It's dark and starting to rain when I get to the church, and Nico's waiting for me in the parking lot. She's struggling around inside her coat, and for a moment one sleeve hangs empty. Then she snakes her arm back inside it. Nico reaches her fingers inside the cuff of her other sleeve and pulls out something lacy and white. "Hold on to this for me," she says, and hands me a warm fistful of lace and elastic. It's her bra. For a couple of hours, she says, "I'm not wearing any pockets." She's smiling with one corner of her mouth, her top teeth biting a little on her bottom lip. Her eyes sparkle with rain and streetlight. Not taking her stuff, I tell her, "I can't. Not anymore." Nico shrugs and tucks the bra back inside the sleeve of her coat. All the sexaholics have gone inside already, to room 234. The hallways are empty with shiny waxed linoleum and bulletin boards on the walls, church news and kids' art projects posted everywhere, finger-painting pictures of Jesus and the apostles, Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Heading for room 234, I'm a step ahead of Nico when she grabs the back of my belt and pulls me over against a bulletin board. The way my gut aches, the bloating and cramps, when she pulls on my belt, the pain makes me belch acid up the back of my throat. My back against the wall, she slips her leg between mine and lifts her arms around my head. Her breasts wedge soft and warm between us. Nico's mouth fits over mine, and we're both breathing her perfume. Her tongue's more in my mouth than in hers, her legs rubbing not my erection, but my impacted bowel. The cramping could mean colorectal cancer. It could mean acute appendicitis, hyperparathyroidism, adrenal insufficiency. See also intestinal obstruction. See also colorectal foreign bodies. Cigarette smoking, nail biting. It used to be my cure for everything was sex, but with Nico swimming against me, I just can't. Nico says, okay, we'll find a different place. She steps back, and I bend double with the ache in my guts, and stumble down to room 234 with Nico still hissing behind me. No, she's hissing. Inside room 234, the group leader saying, we're going to work on the fourth step tonight. Not in there, Nico's saying, until we're standing in the open doorway, being looked at by the crowd of people sitting around a big, low table stained with paint and lumpy with dried paste. The chairs are little plastic scoops, so low, everybody's knees jut up in front of them. These people just stare at us. These men and women, urban legends, these sexaholics. The group leader says, is there anybody here still working on their fourth step? Nico slides against me and whispers in my ear. She whispers, if you go in there, in with all those losers, Nico says, I'm never getting with you again. See also Lisa, see also Tanya. And I come around the table to drop myself into a plastic chair. With everybody watching, I say, hello, I'm Victor. Looking into Nico's eyes, I say, my name is Victor Mancini, and I'm a sexaholic. And I say how I've been stuck on my fourth step for what seems like forever. The feeling is less like an ending than just another starting point. And still leaning in the doorway, not just eye juice, but tears, rolling black mascara tears burst out of Nico's eyes, and she smears them away with her hand. Nico says, she shouts, well, I'm not. And out of the sleeve of her coat, her bra drops on the floor. Nodding at her, I say, and this is Nico. And Nico says, you people can all get fucked. She snatches up her bra, and she's gone. It's then everybody says, hello, Victor. And the group leader says, okay. He says, as I was saying, the best place to find insight is to remember where you've lost your virginity. Chapter 40. Somewhere north-northeast above Los Angeles, I was getting sore, so I asked Tracy if she'd let up for a minute. This is another lifetime ago. With a big hank of white spit looped between my knob and her lower lip, her whole face hot and flushed from choking, still holding my sore dog in her fist, Tracy settles back on her heels and says how in the Kama Sutra it tells you to make your lips really red by wiping them with sweat from the testicles of a white stallion. For real, she says. Now there's a weird taste in my mouth, and I look hard at her lips and my dog the same big purple color. I say, you don't do that stuff, do you? The doorknob rattles, and we both look fast to make sure it's locked. This is that first time, what every addiction is about getting back to, that first time that no subsequent time is ever as good as. Nothing's worse than when a little kid opens the door. What's next worse is when some man throws open the door and doesn't understand. Even if you're still alone, when a kid opens the door, you have to fast, cross your legs, pretend it's all an accident. An adult guy might slam the door, might yell, lock it the next time, you moron, but he's still the only one blushing. After that, what's worse, Tracy says, is being a woman the Kama Sutra would call an elephant woman, especially if you're with what they call a hair man. This animal thing refers to genital size. Then she says, I didn't mean that to sound the way it did. The wrong person opens the door, and you're in their nightmares all week. Your best defense is, unless somebody's on the make, no matter who opens the door and sees you sitting there, they always assume it's their fault, their mistake. I always did. I used to walk in on women or men riding the toilet, on airplanes, on trains, or Greyhound buses, or in those little single-seat, either-or unisex restaurant bathrooms. I'd open the door to see some stranger sitting there, some blonde all blue eyes and teeth with a ring through her navel and wearing high heels, with her G-string stretched down between her knees and the rest of her clothes and bra folded on the little counter next to the sink. Every time this happened, I'd always wonder, why the hell don't people bother to lock the door? as if this ever happens by accident. Nothing on the circuit happens by accident. It could be, on the train somewhere between home and work, you'll open the bathroom door to find some brunette, with her hair pinned up and only her long earrings trembling down alongside her smooth white neck. And she's just sitting inside with the bottom half of her clothes on the floor, her blouse open, with nothing inside but her hands cupped under each breast, her fingernails, her lips, her nipples, all the same cross between brown and red. Her legs as smooth white as her neck, smooth as a car you could drive 200 miles an hour, and her hair the same brunette all over, and she licks her lips. You slam the door and say, "Sorry." And from somewhere deep inside she says, "Don't be." And she still doesn't lock the door, the little sign still saying, "Vacant." How this happens is I used to fly round trip from the East Coast to Los Angeles when I was still in the medical program at USC. During breaks in the school year, 6 times I opened the door on the same yoga redhead, naked from the waist down, with her skinny legs pulled up cross-legged on the toilet seat, filing her nails with the scratch pad of a matchbook, as if she's trying to catch herself on fire, wearing just a silky blouse knotted over her breasts. And 6 times she looks down at her freckled pink self with a road crew orange rug around it, then her eyes, the same gray as tin metal, look up at me slow, and every time she says, "If you don't mind," she says, "I'm in here." 6 times I slam the door in her face. All I can think to say is, "Don't you speak English?" 6 times. This all takes less than a minute. There isn't time to think, but it happens more and more often. Some other trip, maybe cruising altitude between Los Angeles and Seattle, you'll open the door on some surfer blonde with both tanned hands wrapped around the big purple dog between his legs. And Mr. Cool shakes the stringy hair off his eyes, points his dog, squeezed shiny wet inside a glossy rubber. He points this straight at you and says, "Hey man, make the time." It gets to be, every time you go to the bathroom, the little sign says vacant, but it's always somebody. Another woman, 2 knuckles deep and disappearing into herself. A different man, his 4 inches dancing between his thumb and forefinger, primed and ready to cough up the little white soldiers. You begin to wonder, just what do they mean by vacant? Even in an empty bathroom, you find the smell of spermicidal foam. The paper towels are always used up. You'll see the print of a bare foot on the bathroom mirror, 6 feet up, near the top of the mirror. The little arched print of a woman's foot, the 5 round spots left by her toes, and you'll wonder, what happened here? Like with coded public announcements, the Blue Danube Waltz, or Nurse Flamingo, you wonder, what's going on here? You wonder, what aren't they telling us? You'll see a smear of lipstick on the wall, down almost to the floor, and you can only imagine what was going on. There's the dried white stripes from the last pull-out moment when somebody's dog tossed his white soldiers against the plastic wall. Some flights, the walls will still be wet to the touch, the mirror fogged, the carpet sticky. The sink drain is sucked full, choked with every color of little curled hair. On the bathroom counter, next to the sink, is a perfect round outline in jelly, contraceptive jelly, and mucus of where somebody set her diaphragm. Some flights, there's 2 or 3 different sizes of perfect round outlines. These are the domestic leg of longer flights, trans-Pacific or flights over the pole, 10 to 16 hour flights, direct flights, Los Angeles to Paris or from anywhere to Sydney. My Los Angeles trip number 7, the yoga redhead whips her skirt off the floor and hurries out after me. Still zipping herself up the back, she trails me all the way to my seat and sits next to me saying, "If your goal is to hurt my feelings, you could give lessons." She's got this shining soap opera kind of hairdo, only now her blouse is buttoned with a big floppy bow in the front and everything pinned down with a big jewelry brooch. You say it again, "Sorry." This is westbound, somewhere north-northwest above Atlanta. "Listen," she says, "I work just too hard to take this kind of shit. You hear me?" You say, "I'm sorry." She says, "I'm on the road 3 weeks out of every month. I'm paying for a house I never see, soccer camp for my kids. Just the cost of my dad's nursing home is incredible. Don't I deserve something? I'm not bad looking. The least you can do is not shut the door in my face." This is really what she says. She ducks down to put her face between me and the magazine I'm pretending to read. "Don't make like you don't know," she says. "It's not like sex is anything secret." And I say, "Sex?" And she puts a hand over her mouth and sits back. She says, "Oh gosh, I'm so sorry, I just thought."